have to eat.
How can you think of love?
You don't have time to care.
Who's crying, you're guilty of?
Oh, yeah.
For God's sake, give more power to the people.
Out of Chicago, it's the Shy Lights with the classic Give More Power to the People, the title track of their 1971 album. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, I gave it a shot yesterday. I said, well, okay, let me just break down a little bit and see if I could tolerate some couple of minutes at least of this great debate. And guess what? I couldn't. And for the same reason, the historical reason, that is, I tuned in and what I saw told me all I needed to know. Everybody, whether they were Democrat or Republican, female or male, whether they were conservative or liberal, they all agreed that they were having a conversation among themselves, because as the cameras panned the crowd, it was ridiculously white. And I made up my mind a long time ago that I'm not going to tolerate something like that. I won't have my mind insulted by this pretense that we are having a national discussion. Except a lot of the people who should be part of this national discussion are not even visible in the room. So they had their debate and they could keep their debate. But today, you may not know it, but it is Constitution and Citizenship Day, a very patriotic day in the United States of America. For on this day in 1787, delegates to the Constitutional Convention signed the document in the City of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, a date officially commemorated since 1940. Constitution and Citizenship Day extols the two things that are at the core of American ideology and identity, and that's what yesterday was all about, all these issues revolving around the Constitution and around citizenship, because after all, they were discussing matters relating to Americans. But of course, that does not apply and did not apply and has not applied to a large segment of America, historically and even up until today. Legal scholar Paul Finkelman, who teaches constitutional law, legal history, and race and the law at Albany Law School, is going to be giving us a primer in this program on these two issues and the intersection of the Constitution and this matter of citizenship. Because, you know, all of what we're talking about today, when you hear people talk about citizenship, birthright citizenship, and all of this stuff, who's an American, who should be here and whatnot, all of these discussions emanate out of the law of the land, the Constitution, the very thing that is at front and center of our national identity. We will learn in this extended discussion, and it's going to be the first of two parts because it's actually a two-hour-long presentation, and it is important to present this to you and to have you appreciate how deliberate the system has been from the very beginning in identifying who this country belongs to. Who are Americans? And when we get to this discussion, we are, of course, talking about the Dred Scott case, the Dred Scott decision of 1857, which centered on this very question. Who is an American? Who has rights in this country? And these two things are connected, the Constitution and the matter of citizenship and the rights and privileges deriving from citizenship. So when we hear about these discussions today in the context of the 2016 presidential elections, let us understand very clearly that this is not a new issue. So we will hear the first part of Professor Finkelman's lecture. He is speaking here to a class of lawyers in training at Albany Law School in New York. He has done a great deal of research in this area, having written more than 30 books and more than 150 scholarly articles on the matter of legal history, constitutional law, and race and the law. It's a very interesting discussion, the way he breaks down this case. And when you hear him touch on particular issues, you will see how in the 1800s, we had exactly the same issues being dealt with at the court, the same kind of resistance, the same question of race and the law, who belongs here and who does not belong here, who this country really is for. And that matter reaching to the highest levels of the law, and I'm referring to the U.S. Supreme Court. So let's hear from the first part. We will continue this next week, but let's hear Professor Paul Finkelman break down the origins of this question.
I'm going to be doing the Dred Scott case, which is certainly one of the great landmarks of American constitutional law. Our course is, of course, called The Greatest Hits of American Constitutional Law, and the question is whether Dred Scott would be considered a greatest hit or a catastrophic decision. But in any event, it's certainly central to understanding American law. For one thing, we need to realize that part of the response to the Dred Scott decision consists of the post-Civil War amendments, that is the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, ending slavery, giving citizenship to all people born former slaves, and then enfranchise. A central aspect of understanding Dred Scott, particularly the first sentence of the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction of are citizens of the United States. This, of course, is a direct response to Chief Justice Taney's conclusion in the decision that Dred Scott could not be a citizen of the United States because black people could not be a citizen of the United States. Now, of course, there's some irony in this because today there is a political debate over whether we should revise the 14th Amendment. That is, some members of Congress are arguing that we should not have birthright citizenship, at least for the children of undocumented aliens. However, one of the ironies of this, which I'm sure the proponents of changing the 14th Amendment don't understand, is that at the time there were African Americans in the country. Actually, they were African-born people, so they were African immigrants in the sense that they came from Africa, but they were really slaves, who were here illegally because the United States had banned the African slave trade in 1808. So in 1868, when Congress says all persons born or naturalized in the United States, they are in fact giving citizenship to the children of these Africans who were in fact illegally in the United States. So these are some lessons that we might learn from Dred Scott, bringing it up forward. However, what I want to do is turn the clock back to understand the case itself. It is sometimes said that Dred Scott is the cause of the Civil War. I think that exaggerates the importance of any Supreme Court decision. I also think, of course, without Dred Scott, it is likely that a Civil War would have happened because the conflict between slavery and freedom in the United States could not be solved by any constitutional process whatsoever, if for no other reason than the amendment process requires that three-quarters of the states agree to amend the Constitution, In 1860, there are 15 slave states. If those 15 slave states don't, in effect, do us the favor of seceding so we can end slavery without their interfering with the constitutional amendment process, if those 15 slave states stay in the United States, then to this day, in 2010, it would be impossible to amend the Constitution, because if you have 15 slave states voting no on an anti-slavery amendment, you would need 45 free states, three-quarters of the states, which would create a 60-state union. We would indeed then have to turn upstate New York into a separate state. We would be the state of Albany, perhaps, and downstate would be the state of New York. We would have to subdivide the Dakotas into northeast and northwest Dakota and southeast and southwest Dakota, subdivide California into four or five states in order to get to the 45 free states that you would need. So one way of looking at the Constitution and the entire process of change is that some things are not changeable through constitutional amendments. Slavery happened to be one of them because of the very strict and difficult process of amending the Constitution. So that's one piece of background. The other thing that's worth noting is that nine justices issue opinions in this case. This is only the second time in the history of the court before the Civil War that all nine justices issue opinions. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, but tied to the issues that I've just discussed, is the other decision where the nine justices all give an opinion is a case involving immigration known as the passenger cases, so that in fact slavery and immigration become deeply contentious in the period leading up to the Civil War and are both tied together in many ways. One of the issues in the passenger cases is whether the slave states can restrict free blacks from moving into their states. So again, race is tied to all of these issues. Having said that, I now want to give a very brief summary of the case and then turn to the historical background. The case involves a slave, Dred Scott, who has lived in various places, which I'll discuss in a moment, and in 1846 files suit in Missouri to gain his freedom. His argument is that he's lived in free jurisdictions, and once living in a free jurisdiction, he became free. Once free, he can never be re-enslaved. He wins initially in the Missouri courts and then loses in the Missouri Supreme Court. And then, because of an odd twist of fate, he ends up being able to file a diversity suit in federal court, arguing that he is a citizen of Missouri and his owner, who happens to live in New York, is therefore a citizen of New York. Therefore, there is diversity of citizenship between the two parties, which gives the federal courts jurisdiction. He loses before the Supreme Court. In that court decision, Chief Justice Taney reaches three conclusions, all of which seem to be quite shocking to a significant number of Americans. The first conclusion he reaches is that blacks can never be citizens of the United States, even if they live in a free state, even if they can vote in a free state like Massachusetts, even if they hold public office in a free state, because by this time a half a dozen or so blacks had held public office in Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and even Ohio. Taney says they may not be considered citizens of the United States. In other words, it was possible under the Dred Scott decision for somebody to vote in an election for president of the United States, because voting was entirely determined by state rules. So a free black could vote in New York or Massachusetts or New Hampshire or Rhode Island. And yet, under Chief Justice Taney's ruling, not be considered a citizen of the United States. His second ruling, which is equally shocking, is that the Congress has no power to regulate the federal territories beyond setting up the most minimal form of government. And this, of course, is a shock to many people, because since the Articles of Confederation Congress in 1787, or even earlier with the first regulation of the territories in 1783, Congress had been regulating the federal territories. And if we went through the list of federal statutes, we would find one after another of statutes regulating the federal territories, creating different territories so that the Northwest Ordinance creates something called the Northwest Territory in 1787 under the Articles of Confederation, and then that is repassed after the Constitution is written. So the first Congress says, yes, we have the power to regulate these territories. Then the Northwest Territory is divided between the Ohio Territory, when Ohio is about to become a state, and the Indiana Territory, which is the rest of the Old Northwest. And then when Indiana becomes a state, it becomes the Indiana Territory and the Illinois Territory, and then it becomes the Michigan Territory, and then finally it becomes the Wisconsin Territory. So just in that one area where we get five full states and a piece of Minnesota, you get a number of different laws regulating territories. And Congress is always regulating the territories, passing all kinds of legislation for the territories. And Chief Justice Taney says in his opinion, sorry, Congress didn't have the power to do this. One of the justices who is in the majority, Justice John Catron, who is from Tennessee and who's a pro-slavery judge from Tennessee and has no problem with the rest of the decision, he specifically dissents from the notion that Congress can't regulate the territories, because part of his circuit duties, remember in those days the Supreme Court justices went out to the countryside and had circuit duties, part of his circuit had included, among other things, the Arkansas Territory and territories west of the Mississippi, other territories west of the Mississippi, and he says in his dissent as a circuit, well, in his concurrence, but dissenting on this one piece, he says that as a circuit justice, I have sentenced people to death under federal law in the federal territories, and now I'm not about to buy the notion that all of these executions were illegal because Congress didn't have any right to regulate the federal territories. So no matter what position you take on the slavery issue, the notion that Congress can't regulate the federal territories seemed to be shocking and astounding. The third piece of Taney's opinion has to do with the Bill of Rights. Here, Taney argues that the Bill of Rights extends to the federal territories, and so the reason why Dred Scott didn't become free when he was taken to a federal territory, which I'll get to in a couple of minutes, is because the Fifth Amendment prohibits freeing slaves taken to federal territories, because that would be a violation of due process. This is actually the first time that the court uses what today we call substantive due process, making the argument that if you take your property into a federal territory, you cannot simply lose your property because some law says that property can't be brought there. There has to be something more. Taney argues that this is simply not due process of law. I happen, by the way, to think he's right on this point. I think he's right that the Bill of Rights follows the flag. That is, in federal territories, people have freedom of religion, they have freedom of speech, they have freedom of press, they have the right to assemble, they have the right to a fair trial, and the federal government can't arbitrarily take your property away from you merely by some regulation saying this property doesn't belong here. There has to be much more than that. By the way, we might extend this to ask the question, does the Bill of Rights, by the same token, extend, say, to the American base in Guantanamo? Because, after all, if the flag carries the Constitution and the Bill of Rights with it, which is what Chief Justice Taney says, then perhaps anywhere where the American flag flies, the U.S. Constitution flies, and traditional American constitutional rights follow our flag when we exercise jurisdiction over any land anywhere in the world. So that's at least something to think about, and perhaps something to see in Dred Scott. That's the silver lining in what is otherwise the very dark cloud of the Dred Scott decision. So having said all this out, let's now turn to Dred Scott. And of course, we see a picture of him here on the cover of a book about Dred Scott. And this is, by the way, I believe, the only known picture of Dred Scott. The irony of all this case is Dred Scott, of course, loses before the Supreme Court. After he loses, his friend his friends manage to buy his freedom from his owner, and he spends the last year or so of his life being a celebrity in St. Louis, Missouri, and photography is just coming in, so people will pay Dred Scott to sit and get their picture taken with the famous Dred Scott. And this is a picture, which is obviously not a photograph, but a drawing of Dred Scott that appeared in a national publication at the time, the famous slave Dred Scott. Okay. So, Dred Scott is born in Southampton County, Virginia, sometime between 1795 and 1800. We have never yet been able to determine exactly when he was born, so we can only guess. Ironically, born in 1800, which is probably the most likely year for Dred Scott's birth, also in Southampton County, Virginia, is the famous slave Nat Turner, who in 1831 will lead the bloodiest slave rebellion in the history of the United States. So Scott and Turner are both in the same county. There's no reason to believe that they would ever have met or known each other. Scott is owned by a man named Peter Blow, and like many Virginians, Peter Blow abandons Virginia for, if not greener pastures, at least better land or better opportunities. He moves west as thousands of slave owners and, of course, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of slaves are also forced to do during this period. He goes first to Alabama, decides he doesn't like Alabama, and instead moves up to St. Louis, which, of course, is one of the few major cities in the slave South, St. Louis, Missouri. And he arrives there in 1830, and 2 years later, Peter Blow dies. At this point, Dred Scott is sold. One of the important pieces to understand about slavery, which is only incidental to this case, but it's important to understand, is that the single worst day of a slave's life was the day the master died. Because that was the day, or the beginning of the process, which we all understand in law, this is where you are going to have to settle an estate. And how do you settle an estate? You settle an estate often by auctioning off the property of the deceased. And so for every slave, the death of the master means the potential that you will see yourself separated from people that you've known all your life because of sale. Because the only way to settle the estate is to turn the slaves into cash and then divide the cash among the heirs. When Thomas Jefferson dies, for example, more than 200 slaves are sold at auction, including the woman who fathered, who was the mother to a number of his children, Sally Hemings. In his will, Jefferson freed one of Sally Hemings' brothers, a man named Joe Fawcett, who was his blacksmith. Jefferson liked Joe Fawcett, and in fact, he said that Joe could continue to live at Monticello and have his blacksmith tools and be a blacksmith up on Monticello as a free man, and that he could live there with his wife and children. Unfortunately, Jefferson forgot to free his wife and children. So the day Joe Fawcett got his freedom, he watched the rest of his family auctioned off to four or five different purchasers around the state of Virginia, and he spent the rest of his life trying to buy back his family. Nothing quite as dramatic happens to Dred Scott. Peter Blow simply is dead, and Dred Scott is sold to a man named John Emerson. This still must have been a shock for Dred Scott because he'd spent his entire life with the Blow family. He had grown up with Peter Blow's sons who were now young adult men in their 20s, and suddenly he's cut off from all these people. He goes to John Emerson. John Emerson is a physician and a surgeon, and he is also an Army captain. He has just entered the U.S. Army as an Army surgeon. And this is why he needs a slave, because Army officers are expected to provide their own servants while serving in the Army. And living in Missouri, the only way you get a servant is to buy one. So he buys Dred Scott. And then Dr. Emerson is transferred, or Captain Emerson, as he's now officially known, is transferred to Fort Armstrong, which is in the Mississippi River right off of Rock Island, Illinois. Fort Armstrong is an important fort on the edge of civilization. Western Illinois is the far edge of American settlement, American civilization, and of course it's right up against large numbers of Indians who live in Iowa. Dr. Emerson remains in Fort Armstrong from 1833 to 1836, after which he is transferred because Fort Armstrong is no longer necessary, and in fact it falls into disuse and finally ruin, because after Black Hawk's War, there's no need to have the army in western Illinois. You have to move the army further west. Now, two points about living in Fort Armstrong. Fort Armstrong is in the state of Illinois. The state of Illinois is a free state. Slavery is illegal in Illinois. Under the law of Illinois, if you bring a slave to Illinois and live in the state with that slave for a sufficient amount of time, the slave becomes free. Furthermore, Illinois had been free under the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, although it's more important that slavery is illegal in Illinois under the state constitution. In addition to being in Illinois and being in a military fort, Dred Scott also lives outside the military fort because Dr. Emerson, or Captain Emerson, builds a cabin off base. He's an officer. He doesn't want to live on the base. He builds a cabin off base, undoubtedly using Dred Scott as a laborer to help build the cabin. Under Illinois law, this would have made him free because certainly, even if you're passing through Illinois, you can't use a slave as slave laborer in Illinois. And in fact, by 1836, when he leaves Illinois, there are a number of Missouri court precedents, Missouri decisions, which say that if you bring a slave to Illinois and you use that slave as a laborer, that slave becomes free. So there are cases of Southerners migrating to Missouri through the southern piece of Illinois, and they stop and put in a crop of corn because, you know, it's planting season, they've got their slaves, they plant corn, they stay for the summer, they harvest their corn, they sell their corn, they go on to Missouri, and then their slaves sue for freedom and they win because the Missouri courts say you can pass through Illinois, you should have at least a right of transit, but you can't stop and actually bring slavery into Illinois. So under Illinois law, and even more importantly under Missouri law, Dred Scott gains his freedom by helping Dr. Emerson build his house. Now, Emerson's defense to this, if he had been brought into court, might have been, well, I'm an army officer, and I'm required to have a servant, and army officers ought to be exempt from the regular state law because, after all, we are in a federal zone, we're on a military base. Well, the problem, of course, is Emerson's not living on the military base. So he's, in fact, taken himself out of that claim of exemption. In addition, in 1837, the year after Dred Scott leaves Illinois, the Missouri Supreme Court hears an almost identical suit from somebody who had been stationed both at Fort Armstrong and later at Prairie du Chien up in Michigan, in the Michigan Territory, and then came back to Missouri. And the Missouri Supreme Court says, your slave is free because army officers aren't exempt from state law. So you can't bring your slave up to Michigan or to Illinois and keep your slave because you've freed the slave. All of these rulings, by the way, are based on a very old English case, Somerset v. Stuart, which was decided in 1772, before the American Revolution. In Somerset, the Court of King's Bench, the highest court in England, declares that if you voluntarily bring a slave into England, that slave becomes free, because as Lord Mansfield says, you can only establish slavery by positive law. That is statutory law. If you want to have slavery in England, Parliament has to pass an act. In Somerset's case, Somerset is a slave in Virginia owned by an officer in the customs department of the British bureaucracy. He is stationed in Virginia. He moves back to London. He takes Somerset with him. Somerset runs away. Stuart goes and captures Somerset, drags him off to a ship, has him chained up in the bottom of the ship, and gives directions to the ship owner to take Somerset to the Caribbean and sell him and bring him back the money. Somerset gets a writ of habeas corpus by English opponents of slavery, and Lord Mansfield says, "You're free." By the way, should you ever read this case, it has enormously good advice for lawyers, because at the very beginning of the case, Lord Mansfield tells the lawyers on both sides of the case, "I think you should settle this case as previous cases along this line have been done." And Stuart, who owns Somerset, refuses to settle because he doesn't want to lose his slave. Because after all, Somerset can only settle for freedom. He can't sort of settle, "Oh, well, I'll have a more mild form of slavery or something." And Stuart refuses to settle. Stuart is backed, in fact, by rich absentee landowners who own sugar plantations in the British Caribbean. And they want the decision. When the case comes back before Mansfield, Mansfield says that, "Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. Fiat justitia rulat colum," which he says in the opinion, it's in the Latin, so I have somebody to translate it for me. You know, when the judge says, "Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall," you have to figure, in the case of Stuart, that you're going to be the losing party, and he is. So the Somerset principle is considered to be a piece of American common law. And that piece of American common law says that if a slave is brought to a jurisdiction where there is no slavery, the slave becomes free, and you can only establish slavery by some kind of statutory law, not simply by common law practice. Had Dred Scott sued in Illinois, he might have been free. One question we always ask is, why didn't he sue in Illinois? The most likely answer is that Rock Island, Illinois, Fort Armstrong, is very, very isolated. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's in the woods. There's not much support there. He's not likely to find a lawyer who's ready to rush forward and take his case. He may not even know he's entitled to be free. He is, after all, illiterate. He cannot read and write. He's on a military base. It's very unlikely that anybody's telling him, "Hey, Dred, you ought to sue for freedom. You'll win." It is also possible that for Dred Scott, his job as Captain Emerson's slave is not such a bad job. He is essentially the personal servant to an Army officer. He sees how the enlisted men are treated in the Army, which is far worse, perhaps, than he's being treated. He's getting 3 square meals a day. What's he going to do on the Illinois frontier? He has no compelling reason to seek freedom. He may even be enjoying the adventure of camping out in the Illinois forests. Who knows? In any event, in 1836, the Army closes Fort Armstrong and sends Dr. Emerson with Dred Scott to Fort Snelling, which is today in the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. At the time, it is part of the Wisconsin Territory. The Wisconsin Territory had been carved out of the Michigan Territory, which, as I already said, was carved out ultimately of the Northwest Territory. All of the territorial acts creating these territories banned slavery. The Wisconsin Enabling Act creating the Wisconsin Territory specifically banned slavery. So by a series of congressional acts, slavery is flat out illegal in Fort Snelling. But he brings Dred Scott to Fort Snelling, and at Fort Snelling there are other slaves, including a woman owned by the federal Indian agent, a man named Major Lawrence Taliaferro, and her name is Harriet Robinson, and Dred Scott marries Harriet Robinson at Fort Snelling. So for Dred Scott, the trip to Fort Snelling, he discovers a wife. It may be that they were the only marriageable partners for each other at the fort. It may be that they were in love. Who knows? We can't really know these things. Now, Lawrence Talaferro, who is known as Major Talaferro, and who is the Indian agent working for the War Department as an Indian agent, he believes in formal marriages. He, in fact, campaigns heavily to get Indians to marry each other, and he'll perform the ceremonies. He's also trying to get rid of polygamy and other things which he considers to be immoral among the Indian nations. So he performs a wedding ceremony for Dred and Harriet. Now, there is at least one scholar who's argued that this proves that Dred Scott is free, because the argument goes, well, you should all know this, what is a marriage? Anybody had family law? What is a marriage? A contract between who?
Two people getting married. And
no.
The state.
And the state, right? It's a contract with three parties. The one spouse, the second spouse, and the state. Can a slave sign a contract? The answer is no, of course not. You can't let slaves have contracts. So the argument would be, if the Indian agent performs a wedding ceremony and says, I hereby declare you man and wife under the laws of the Wisconsin Territory, then there is a contract between Dred Scott, Harriet, and the, in this case, the Wisconsin Territory, and so Dred Scott must be free. The problem with this argument, which has been made by a law professor in Iowa, is that it doesn't make any sense within the context of the institution of slavery itself. Because what we know about the American South is that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Southern masters have marriage ceremonies performed for their slaves. Sometimes they bring in a minister who, under the laws of the state, is authorized to conduct marriages. And so the minister may say, I now declare you by the laws of Alabama, and more importantly, by the laws of God, husband and wife. Does that make them legally married? Of course not. Because what we also know about slavery, as Joe Fawcett finds when Thomas Jefferson dies, is that the owner can dissolve the marriage, the union, whenever the owner chooses to sell off one of the spouses. Similarly, the owner can dissolve the parental relationships whenever the master chooses to sell off one of the children. So slave owners, for a variety of reasons, have marriage ceremonies. Slave owners are not stupid. They understand that stable marriages produce happier slaves. They understand that if somebody is happily married, he is less likely to run away. If somebody is happily married, she is less likely to commit violence on the plantation, because that is going to interfere with her personal life. In other words, slave owners understand that the process of getting the most out of your slaves is not simply one of force. It's also one of psychology. It's also one of the carrot as well as the stick. And they, of course, understand that happy marriages lead to children in an age before there's any kind of understood birth control. And slave children are simply more income for the slave owner. Slave children are the stock dividends that you get by owning slaves. So for someone like Dr. Emerson, having Dred Scott and Harriet have a formal marriage is simply a perfectly logical, normal thing to do. It does not prove that Dred Scott is free. It only proves that Emerson and Major Talaferro believe in this ceremony, in this formal recognition of a marriage. Subsequent events illustrate how true this is. In October 1837, Emerson is transferred to St. Louis, Missouri, to Jefferson Barracks. Emerson decides that the weather is too dangerous to travel for Dred and Harriet, so he leaves Dred and Harriet in Fort Snelling and rents them out. He has now, of course, added slavery, not merely brought slaves into Minnesota or the Wisconsin Territory, he has now brought the institution of slavery, which includes renting out your slaves for a profit. He rents them out, and they stay working for other army officers in Minnesota. At this point, of course, there's no master controlling them, but they don't go anywhere. In November 1837, the Army decides they don't really need Dr. Emerson in Jefferson Barracks. Rather, they need him in Fort Jessup, which is in Louisiana. And so he goes all the way down the Mississippi River and sets up shop in Fort Jessup. Dred and Harriet are still in Minnesota, still hired out. In February 1838, Dr. Emerson marries a woman named Eliza Irene Sanford. She goes by the name of Irene Sanford, but her first name is actually Eliza. Irene Sanford is a Virginian-born white woman who comes from a slaveholding family. The name is spelled S-A-N-F-O-R-D. Eventually, her brother, John F.A. Sanford, will be the formal defendant in the Supreme Court decision. And if you look at the case, of course, the case is always spelled, and here, just want to go to the next. You'll note that the case is spelled S-A-N-D-F-O-R-D. The reason for that is because there is a mistake by the clerk of the Supreme Court. He adds its second D to Sanford's name, and that spelling error is forever enshrined in American constitutional law. I sometimes think it's simply one more example of how weird and bizarre this case is, that they can't even get the names of the plaintiff and the defendant right. They get the plaintiff right, they can't get the name of the defendant right in the case. In any event, he marries Irene Sanford, and now, of course, he needs his slaves, because now he's setting up a household, and he really needs these slaves, Harriet and Dred. And so he sends a message by steamboat all the way up to Fort Snelling, and he says that you should now come and come down. So Fort Snelling, of course, is way up here, and they go all the way down the Mississippi River to northern Louisiana by themselves. Dred and Harriet, two slaves on a steamboat. One of the great questions for historians is, why do they travel well more than 1,200 miles all alone? If they had gotten off the boat in the Wisconsin Territory here, if they had gotten off the boat in the Illinois Territory here, if they had gotten off the boat in the new Iowa Territory, where there are a number of Quaker settlements and there are a number of people who are really opposed to slavery, they could have gotten off the boat in any of these places and said, hey, we think we're free, or hey, we're runaway slaves, or we're here, we don't want to go down to Louisiana. There would have been lots of people who would have protected them. They could have also stopped in St. Louis, and where there is a big free black community, and they could have hid out in St. Louis, merged into the free black community. Maybe Dr. Emerson would have found them in St. Louis, maybe not. They could also, I suppose, when they got to here, which is Cairo, Illinois, they could have gotten on a steamboat and gone up the Ohio River and into the east, or to the only free jurisdiction, completely free jurisdiction in North America, British Canada. Again, one of the ironies of this period is that the only place where you're truly guaranteed of freedom, at least in English-speaking North America, Mexico also has banned slavery, but the only place where a slave could realistically hope to be free is under the protection of the Queen of England, which is ironic, since America, of course, becomes a nation by fighting against England for our liberty. In any event, they go all the way down to Fort Jessup. My assumption is that they go to Fort Jessup for, yes?
Harriet was pregnant at this time?
Harriet will be pregnant when she goes back up to Fort Snelling. But by the way, this is, you know, my friends who've been career officers say, you know, this is just how it is in the military. You know, up the Mississippi, down the Mississippi, up the Mississippi, go here, go there. We need you now. We've changed our mind. You're going someplace else. So she will be pregnant going back up the Mississippi on the way back to Fort Snelling in a little while. They're not pregnant yet. My guess is this. Either Dred and Harriet, Dred we know is illiterate. Harriet may be quasi or semi-literate, but certainly is not educated. If she can read a little bit, she picked it up somewhere. Here we have these two slaves with no great skill set, no knowledge of the world, probably very little knowledge of a money economy. I mean, we take for granted knowledge of things like a money economy, but if you're a slave where you, in fact, never handle money, if you are a slave who is, we talk about people being literate, but the other side of that is being numerate. That is, if you don't understand counting, if you don't understand money, if you can't write your numbers, then how can you succeed as a free person in a world where you have to have these minimal skills just to get by? So one possibility is Dred and Harriet look at the world and say, working for Dr. Emerson is not a bad deal. We could be a lot worse off, and freedom is very scary. Freedom isn't giving us what we need. It is also possible that Dr. Emerson has told Dred, look, I'm going to do this army thing for a few years, and then I'm going to resign from the army. And when I resign from the army, I will no longer need a slave, and I will free you. So stick with me for a couple of years. Stick with me through my military service, and then you will be legally free, and you don't have to worry about being a fugitive slave. You don't have to worry about somebody hunting you down and dragging you back to slavery. It is also possible that they're simply scared. Who knows? But they don't do it. They travel down. They're not chained up. They're not, you know, they just travel down the Mississippi River. And they end up in Louisiana. And then in October 1838, having just arrived in April, the army tells Emerson, well, it's time to go back to Fort Snelling. And so the whole crew goes back to Fort Snelling. Along the way, Harriet gives birth in the river between Illinois and Iowa, somewhere up here. And so her child is born either in the free state of Illinois or the free territory of Iowa. And again, one of the rules of slave law is that if you are born in a free place, you are free by birth. This, again, it has implications for sort of modern 14th Amendment debates over the status of children of undocumented aliens and other people. If you're born in the United States, you're a citizen of the United States. If you're born in Iowa, you are free in Iowa. Okay. So that's the situation. Then in May 1840, Dr. Emerson is shipped out of Fort Snelling. This time they send him from way up here all the way down to Florida to be a physician in a war known as the Second Seminole War. It is, by the way, a war that the United States never wins. Ultimately, we simply stop trying to subdue the Seminole, which is why there are still Seminole tribes in Florida to this day. Emerson then leaves the army. He's fed up with military service. He moves back to St. Louis. By the way, while he's in Florida, Dred and Harriet and his wife are in St. Louis, where they have another child. And he comes back from Florida. He resigns from the army. And then, oddly enough, he moves to Iowa. He does not stay in the slaveholding jurisdiction of Missouri. He moves to the Iowa Territory, where he sets up a medical practice. And in 1843, Dr. Emerson dies. At this point, Irene hires Dred out, not Harriet, by the way, just Dred. She hires Dred to another army officer who takes him to Texas after Texas statehood. And he stays in Texas until the eve of the Mexican War, when he is sent back to Missouri. We don't know whether he's sent back because the army officer who's hired him has said, I'm about to go to war, I don't want a slave around, or whether Irene Emerson says, you're about to go to war, send me my slave back because I don't want my slave dying in the war. In any event, Dred Scott goes back to Missouri, and in 1846, he attempts to purchase his freedom for himself, his wife, and his now two daughters. The question of where would he get the money to purchase his freedom is easily answered. Remember Peter Blow. He has a couple of sons, and he now has a son. He's dead, of course, but he has two sons, and there is a son-in-law, and the two Blow brothers and their brother-in-law get together and offer Dred Scott enough money to buy his freedom, and then he can pay them back gradually as he works. While this is going on, the Scotts, of course, are still working for Irene Emerson. She refuses to allow them to buy their freedom. Why does she refuse to allow them to buy their freedom? Because she says that she needs them. And of course she does need them in the sense that she is a middle-class widow in a slave city, and she needs somebody to help run the house. Imagine what it's like to have a house in a town where there's no running water, no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no indoor heating. Everything is done by intensive amounts of labor. And so she needs Harriet, if you think about the way women dressed in the 1840s with hoop skirts and whalebone corsets, you need somebody to help you dress. So if she lets the Scots get their freedom, then she simply has to buy other slaves. And why buy other slaves when you have two perfectly good slaves already? In 1846, then, Dred Scott sues for his freedom. His suit is based, of course, on the Somerset decision and on a huge number of decisions by the Missouri Supreme Court, all of which say the same thing, all of which say that if you bring a slave to a free jurisdiction, that slave becomes free. The only exception is if you're simply briefly passing through the free jurisdiction for a day or two. The case begins in 1846. It is delayed because, and this is again one of the bizarre ironies of the case, he sues Irene Sanford Emerson, and Irene Sanford Emerson says, well, I don't own Dred Scott. And Dred Scott doesn't have a witness to prove that she owns him. So the irony of the case is he loses his case and he's remanded to the person who claims she doesn't own him. He then has to go to the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Supreme Court rules that he's entitled to a new trial. And at the new trial, which finally takes place in 1850, it takes a while. There's a cholera epidemic. There's a big fire in St. Louis. Justice grinds slowly. In 1850, a jury of 12 white men sitting in St. Louis declares Dred, Harriet, and their children all to be free. Dred Scott has won. And this is absolutely consistent with a series of Supreme Court decisions in Missouri going all the way back to 1824. The problem is, that year, there is a new constitution going into effect which has an elected Supreme Court. The elected Supreme Court.
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, and we're listening to Professor Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School detailing the Dred Scott case that led to the famous or infamous decision in 1857 that is deeply rooted in the questions that are in full swing right now about the immigration and about citizenship, birthright citizenship, amending the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, constitutional protections for people who are immigrants, whether documented or undocumented. All this stuff that is swirling around us now today, emanating out of this case. This is going to be the first part of two parts, but it is important. All legal scholars agree this is the case to understand. And as you've heard so far, Professor Finkelman has touched on other issues that are very much in play. The question of constitutional rights, the right to marry, the issue of
the state of Missouri. And we know Ferguson, Missouri, and St. Louis, Missouri, being the epicenter of major upheavals around this question of inequitable racial treatment. We know that these are critical issues. So when we hear of these discussions popping up as new discussions, you have to have a point of reference here. This is nothing new. And again, it is the slavery experience and the efforts made by a bunch of people all the way back in the 1800s, the early and mid-1800s, to deal with these questions. So today, as the nation commemorates Constitution and Citizenship Day, we ought to be pretty mindful that a lot of stuff that is presented to us is brand new, major issues of the day, current events, aren't really just current events, but have a long and very, very dark history. Thanks for joining me today on this. We'll return to this a lecture next week on Thursday, and we will get to appreciate, this is what I liked about this lecture by Professor Finkelman, is that he's dealing with the law, which is the apparatus of oppression, and all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, how the lives of Dred Scott and his wife and his children, all the way back in the 1850s, laid the groundwork for the discussions that we have today. And if people today still believe that they ought to go along with the okey-doke rather than say, we have a different point of reference. That circus that happened last night where they are taking care of business as they define it, you have an entirely different point of reference, but you need to become very familiar with it. Thanks again for joining me, and thank you for the pleasure and great privilege of your company. Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's more great programming. See you tomorrow. For God's sake, you better get